My name is Mildred and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. This is not what I planned to do tonight, but here I am. You know, this morning when I woke up, I did what I usually do, offered myself to the Creator, and said, I wonder where I will be of use today, but wherever it is, I will do my best. So here I am, and I will do my best. It's wonderful to be here. I want to thank you, Dick and Barbara. You know, and I love the work that you do here, and you bring a special something to this event. I've often said that when you go to a conference or a retreat, I can always kind of tell there's something about the spirit there when the committee or the organizers are filled with love. And I always feel that here. It's always great. So I'm delighted to be here. And, of course, to see people that I love dearly and haven't seen for 3 or 4 years. So I'm here to share with you my experience, my strength, and my hope, if you want to put it that way, or what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. You know, my dry date is May the 18th, 1973. So I'm soon going to be celebrating 50 years. And I have to say, that, thank you, but I know what that clap is for, really. But it seems to me that as the years go by, I appreciate the program ever more and love it more and love the big book and read the big book, and I swear to you that every day I pick up that book, somebody has written something in there that I never saw before. And of course, that's not the truth. I just didn't see it the same way. And if you've heard me speak, you may say, well, I've heard her before. No, you haven't. You've never heard Mildred on this date in this year, 2022, because life has changed me. God's grace has changed me. And I trust that God's grace has changed you. And the soul that is hearing what I'm saying today is going to get a different message. The story, the actual events of how I got sober, that remains the same. But everything else is really very different. I want to start with a little story that I think, and I love stories, as you said, Dick, because they, if you hear them right, there's such a powerful message there. Last night, a friend of mine called me, and we've been in communication, but I wasn't in communication with her about 2 years ago. I didn't know this had happened to her. And last night she said to me something about my second job, and I won't identify the company she's working for, but she said, I'm working for that company, and I love it so much. And I said, what? I didn't know. I thought you were doing such and such. Well, she said I was. But about 5 years ago, she said, I got cancer. I didn't know that. And she said I had 2 or 3 operations. And when the cancer, when we were done with that, she said, I decided that I had to make a change. And I did some research, and out of that, I now am selling this skin product, which I have really researched, and now she said, I just love it. I'm so excited about it. And she said, it's helping people and me too. After we had this conversation, I thought, is that not exactly what I've been looking for these days? To see how God works in the world. It's fascinating. You know, I used to look and see how life happened in the world. I not look to see what is God doing in the world. And the more I look for that, the more I see. It might be a book that I couldn't find, or it might be a credit card I couldn't find as today, and then it shows up. How does that happen? You can say, well, it's just chance, or, you know, you can call it what you will. I like to think that it is God paving the way to make things, when it's right, it happens the right way. Just like my friend, who is now making more money than she ever made, but it was through the cancer. As she said, I don't think I would have ever changed jobs unless I had the necessity of what happened. So, I'll tell you, I am the youngest of 10 children. I'm the baby of that family, actually. And as one of my nieces said to me recently, she said, you were a menopausal baby. And what she meant by that, she was absolutely right. My parents were done having babies. When you had 9, that should be good enough, even in the Catholic Church. And then one day my mother at that time was 44 years old. To find out that she was pregnant again and to bring the diapers and the whole business into play again. So what happened to me, I didn't really realize this. I had a terrible relationship with my mother. I happen to believe their past lives. You don't have to believe that. But I've seen too much that I can't explain if everything is from this lifetime. But it just felt to me like there's a mother. She was loved in the community. She was loved by the people in the church. She was loved by the family. And then there was me. And she and I had a terrible relationship. I didn't like her, and I don't think she liked me. It was not the kind of thing that I could say, I don't like that about you. I just didn't. I'm saying that for a reason. Because I grew up, and this isn't about let's whine a bit about childhood. I think childhood is very important because, you know, I'm going to be 90 in a couple of weeks. And a good-looking 90, wouldn't you say? And I'm going to be 50 years sober. And I know that I still have the effects of how I was raised as a child. And you know, what really pleases me, I read some of the great mystics. And you know what some of the great mystics said? Before we paid much attention to the subconscious and all that stuff, they all said it. That, like the Jesuits used to say, give me a child till he's 7 and you give me the man. And that was the idea. They understood that at that age, you're impressionable. So I was raised because I never understood who I am. I never understood why my life has been so different from that of my brothers and sisters. I never understood. I didn't have a miserable life. I had a great life. I had everything I could have possibly had. My brothers and sisters loved me. But, see, my father was a farmer. He was a wealthy farmer, and we owned thousands of acres of land. So I had 4 big brothers, and those big brothers were my idols. You know what they had, too? They seemed to have power. The women in my life, they seemed to have gardens and babies, and I wanted no part of that. I wanted what my brothers seemed to have. They were listened to. They seemed to be somebody. And that's what I lusted after, and that's what I looked for. And I didn't understand all that. But I can tell you, I grew up alone. I grew up in a family of 10 people, but I grew up alone. I didn't fit with the rest of that family. By the time I came along, like their experience of life had been, they had to work at that time because at that point, my father hadn't made the kind of money he eventually made. They had to work. I didn't. I was the cute little girl. I was cute little Mildred. But I didn't fit. I didn't realize this. What was important to them had nothing to do with little Mildred. What do we do with little Mildred? Well, she's so smart, so she goes to school. But the thing was, I grew up feeling isolated. I never understood this. I know now that it's part of being in the third dimension. And I remember Chuck Chamberlain in the days when Chuck tried to help me. And he would say, your problem is you think you're separate. And because Chuck would sit with me by the hour. And I don't know what we talked about. But the one thing I always remember every time he came to Prince Albert and every time we sat together, I see you nod, Bob, you know, and he'd say, your problem is you think you're separate. What? That's not right. He said, you have one problem. You think you're separate. I didn't understand that. I understand it perfectly today. I don't believe I'm separate anymore. And so I don't have those kinds of problems. But I have the effects of childhood because I am the person of my childhood. So I graduated from grade school at 11. And I graduated from high school at 14. All right. But I always felt alone. I always felt different. And at 5, I took a drink. There was another factor in our life. One of those 9 had been injured at birth. And she was what the school system said. She was retarded. And therefore, they kept her, you know. That would be 85 years ago or 86, whatever. And the school system didn't know what to do. They didn't understand all the ramifications of the way we understand it today. And so they kept her in grade 3 till she was 16. You can only imagine, if you've got a heart, that this was tough. The kids made fun of her. Her name was Dorothy, and they called her Dumb Dora. And I loved her, and I felt it was so hard and so cruel. And so I went to the brothers and sisters I had. They loved me. If I asked for milk, I got milk. I asked them to fix Dora. I asked them to do this, to dance with her and do the things that I, in my childish mind, saw would help her to feel okay. And it didn't happen. I understand now. You know, I said to somebody today, you have to remember, some things happened when society and people thought different. Like, people in my family didn't discuss feelings. They lived well. Like, my father, you know, he left a lot of money aside so that Dora could be looked after and Dora would never have to go to an institution. He knew how to, he did what he knew how to do then. Now, I think sometimes we babble endlessly about emotion and how we feel and what's going on and don't do anything. He, on the other hand, took the action, but didn't. Nobody ever explained to me what was going on with Dora. So, at 5, I took a drink. And I think that every time I read the doctor's opinion, I thank God for Dr. Silkworth. He knew what he was talking about. He said they're restless, irritable, and discontent until they again experience the ease and comfort. The sense, he said, of ease and comfort. Big difference between ease and comfort and the sense of ease and comfort. I got the sense of ease and comfort. And when I lost that because the effect wore off, I needed more. And I can tell you that for 35 years, that's what I chased. I didn't care about morals. I didn't care about ethics. I didn't care about anything but this. I used to call it the stuff in the bottle. I have to have the stuff in the bottle because then I function. You know, I can remember those days. I can remember what that felt like to just look at the world and just, I just couldn't see. I just couldn't see. Like, I'm smart. Yeah, they call me brilliant, so who cares? You know, I didn't fit, and I didn't know how to fit. And I remember about being about 6 or 7 years old, and I went to school over here, and I went to catechism over there. And I remember going to catechism, and the little girls wouldn't play with me. I can hardly, at this age, 89 years old, I can hardly tell it without crying because there's something in me just squeezes and hurts. And they didn't play with me. And I can remember running across the playground with them, after them, saying, "Why don't you play with me? I'm a nice little girl." And they just laughed and ran away. I know some things today I didn't know then. I know that the energy and the thinking we carry, it's an energy that we put out, and people respond to that energy. I didn't know that then. And then I'd have money in my pocket, and if you play with me, I'll give you money. I'll take you to the corner store, and I'll buy you something. And every time I say that, I see my life stretched out ahead of me. Because that's what I did in life. You want sex? I'll give you sex. You want money? I'll give you money. You want help from me? I'll give you that. I'll give you whatever you need without any kind of reference point to myself other than the false self, because the false self was always the reference point. What can I do? How can I deal with you in such a way that you will treat me in a way that I can feel okay? You know, I think we come to the planet, as I said, you don't have to believe this, but I'm a very different person from the kind of person I was when I was 5. And that's not just about age. It's the way I think, the way I value life, the way I value myself, the way I get along with people, how I, the kind of ways I think about you, but above all, the kind of ways I think about myself. How do you take a sickie like me? I'll tell you, once I was into the booze, I was locked up 32 times in psych wards. I had 38 electroshock treatments. I shouldn't have a brain. You know, I had much therapy and I couldn't stop. And the thing was, I didn't want to stop drinking. I could not bear my life the way I felt. I always felt alone. The only time I felt okay, and the only time I could act okay, was that first part of the drinking experience where I got it into me, and that effect, the deadening of those old ideas, happened. So when I was 17, I went to a convent. That's not smart when you're an alcoholic. And by the time I was 17, I was well into it. You know, I often think, what went so wrong in my life? And I'm not complaining. I'm grateful for it. Because you know what it did? It drove me to the bottom. And it drove me ultimately to seek God. And I don't regret any of that. I saw something. I was listening to a lecture the other day, And I saw something that kind of woke me up. It was a video that was shown, and there were some people dressed in white, and there were some people dressed in black. And the instruction was to the people who were watching, count how many times the people in white throw the ball to the other side. And then you count how many times the people in black throw the ball to the other side. And then he counted. People said so many times, and the people in black said so many times. And then he said, how many of you saw the gorilla walking across the stage? Gorilla? And he showed it again. And there it was. And I had watched the video just like everybody else, like a sucker counting how many times the ball was going across. And there was the gorilla walking among the people. And his conclusion was, and I agree with him, we see basically what we're programmed to see. And that explained a lot of my life. And I was programmed, you see, getting back to Dora. You know, I went to God in my childhood days and asked God to fix. Because, you know, Saskatchewan, beautiful sky and beautiful sunsets and all that. And God didn't fix it, not on my terms. I didn't know about step three. I didn't know the writings of the big book about what happens with the false self and how he says we have to be rid of that false self or it kills us. Pretty powerful stuff. And so, you know, I think, because somebody, or I shouldn't say some, often people will say to me, how did you stay drunk in a convent? The gorilla walking across the stage, you didn't expect to see it, and therefore you didn't see it. You didn't expect to see Mildred drunk, but that's what happened. Anyway, I married my psychiatrist, not smart, and that was a disaster. I've learned something from that. My soul talks to me, and I believe your soul talks to you. Because I remember the day, the very first date I had with that man. And my soul said, don't do this. Don't have another this and this. It hadn't begun yet, but don't do this anymore. This is not good. And that turned into a situation. He wasn't my problem, but he was violent. And I went through a whole period of getting beaten black and blue, and I didn't know how to handle it. I'm a sicko. So, I met Dr. Hoffer. And if you know our history, you know Dr. Abe was, at the time, it was before LSD had hit the streets. And he was using LSD with schizophrenics successfully, if you know the history, because he died several years ago, and before he did, he was brought to Toronto to receive a Lifetime Service Award from the Orthomolecular Society. I was so proud. But at that time, he was using LSD successfully. And if you know Bill's story, Bill was always looking for ways that he could help alcoholics. You know, nobody had been successful with alcoholics. And he wanted to help and see if there were ways it could be easier for us to stay sober. So there's Dr. Hoffer. And he was in one of the psych wards, he was a psychiatrist there. And he went to my doctor and he said, this girl doesn't have all these mental illnesses. He said, she's alcoholic and should go to AA. So eventually, that's what happened. I went to AA. I was excited because one of my brothers was in big trouble at one point, and my father called me and said, you know, he isn't going to die. He's alcoholic. And he said, I don't know, this would have been in the 50s. And he said, this organization has come to Saskatchewan. And he said, your brother is sober. And my father started to cry. And he said, it's so good. He said, they call it Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we hear so much babbling about AA these days. You know, sometimes I think, can you imagine, like Scott we talked about that in the car today, about how when people have not heard about AA, what a wonder. It was a wonder to my dad, and it stuck in my consciousness. And so when Dr. Hoffer said, we're going to send you to AA, I thought, great, I'm going to be transformed. Yep. And so I went to AA, and I sat in the front seat right where you're sitting. And I sat there for 5.5 years, stoned. I can't. You think, you're sick, you know that? I sat there stoned because I can't do life without alcohol. I cannot do life, and I don't want to do life without alcohol. Or something that changes, alters the way I perceive the world. And so I wound up, eventually, our marriage broke up. It wasn't very long, maybe a year. I'm not big at marriage. And eventually we lost everything. He was alcoholic too. And I wound up on a park bench. I was a tramp. You know, if you go downtown and you see people on park bench, that's exactly the way I was. I was there for 2 months. And the morning of May the 18th, the RCMP picked me off the bench and took me to a psych ward. And I woke up out of a blackout in the psych ward, not knowing what I had done. To this day, I don't know what I had done, but they picked me up and took me there. That was a Friday. And on Sunday, I could walk again, and the nurse came in, and she said, she gave me some very bad news. She said, you're going to be discharged today. Now, for many people to be discharged from a psych ward, this is good. For me, it was not good at all. I had no home. I had no money. I was a broken human person. I had no friends, and my mother had said, you are not welcome here. You know, I've asked you not to drink, and if you cannot pull your life together, she said, you're not welcome here. And so I had nothing. And that morning I did what I like to call an inventory of my life. Not as fourth step, just an inventory. Like, how do people live? Like, what's the matter with me? Like, I looked at it and I couldn't figure it out. Like, what's wrong with me? I've tried education, I've tried religion, I've tried the convent, I've tried music, I've tried teaching, I've tried all kinds of things, and I can't pull it off. I just can't find the way to be okay. And so I made a decision. I'm going to end it. And I asked the nurse to get my coat. And I can tell you, the morning of May the 20th, when my eyes opened, I had no idea that for me that was going to be a crucial day in my life, and I would never be the same again. I stood there. She went to get my coat. I stood there. And, you know, this brings up the idea of the higher power and how that higher power works. And what is it? that makes it possible for us to receive grace. Did I pray? No. Wouldn't have prayed. Did I ask? No, I didn't. I made a decision. I'm out of here. I'm done. And I remember thinking, I don't know what's on the other side, and I don't care. It can't be worse than this. And at that point, I had a spiritual experience. 1 minute, that's me, and the next minute, I'm standing there, stunned. Did I hear anything? No. You know, when God makes babies, and he puts 50 trillion cells together in that little body that we call the fetus, he doesn't make noise. God doesn't have to make noise. That's why I think the book says, be still, and know that I am God. I didn't see anything, I didn't hear anything, but I knew I was changed. My soul talked to me again. And I remember standing there saying, I don't have to drink again. I'm clean inside. I remember it very clearly. But I don't know how to live sober. You'll have to send me somebody. And there was a rap on the door. Honest to God, you tell me, how does this happen? And this man, right at that crucial minute, you know, and if you think about it, you've had these two in some way, shape, or form where the right thing happened, the right thing was said right at the right time, and a man stood there, and he said, I saw you at breakfast, and he said, you're in trouble, aren't you, and you're an alcoholic. And I said, yeah, you want to make something of it? And he said, no. He said, I came to offer you help. And he told me about a hospital treatment center. In 1973, there were no treatment centers in Toronto, but that place. Dr. Bell, good Dr. Bell, had an insight that he said, there's certain addicts and people with trouble. He said, I think they need extra help. And so he introduced a program that he had really picked up from AA. He used to go to AA meetings, and that's where, whatever. And so this man said, I will take you there tomorrow if you will go. And I said, yes, I'll go. And I still remember that afternoon I stayed in the hospital, and I remember I couldn't believe the joy I felt inside and the smile on my face, because I thought, I'm going to get better. There's hope for me. And you know what? It was true. In 49 years and months on my way to 50 years, I have never had the compulsion, and I have never had the obsession. It's done. It doesn't mean I'm not an alcoholic. I'm still an alcoholic, but I've never been troubled that way. You know what it feels like to me? It feels like I got to do 40 years, and God said, go to it. You try and figure out what this life is about. I'll give you 40 years. And at the end of that 40 years, I reached that blessed place. I said it. That blessed, unbelievable place called bottom. And that was the end of that. And that was necessary. And then God said, okay, you made it. Now you're going to have to find out what life is really like. You're not going to drink, because I've no compulsion to drink. You're not going to be obsessed with that. You're going to do the real work. And that's exactly what these years have been. I went through that. I went to that place, and then I went to Skid Row. And, you know, it just amazes me. as I look at my life. I have never been without what I have needed. Just like that man rapping on the door right at the right moment. What did I need? I needed poverty. I needed to find out what life was really like. And I lived my first year sober on Skid Row. I was broken. And I remember Dr. Maharaj. He was my angel. I have never been left without the people I have needed. You know, I look down at Bob, and Bob has often been the angel I have needed, whether he knows it or not. I'd come and sit and listen and hear exactly how I could incorporate the spirits of the program. Anyway, I used to go, and he used to say to me, "You come and see me." And I would go and see him once a week, and we would sit. I don't know what we talked about. I remember one thing. He was a dedicated Hindu. He didn't preach religion. But what he did was he lived it. And he used to say to me, "Mildred," he said, "whatever you do, don't drink and don't take drugs." And he said, "I don't know how this is going to work out." But he said, "It will work out. You will. I can promise you that." And he was right. I lived in poverty for, sweeping a factory floor. I've got a sponsee now who's very wealthy, and I always tell her, "I wish you had poverty like I do." Because she doesn't have to get up and work. I had to. I swept the factory floor. And my dear friend Tom Ivester, who is now gone, he used to laugh with me because he swept the streets of Flint, Michigan after he got out of the penitentiary. Two sweepers. And at the end of that, the God shot started to happen. The first God shot was the voice that said, I don't know if it was a voice, I don't know. I know that I knew I was to go and look for a job. I'm an educator. I'm good at it. I went to look for a job. There were three advertised. I phoned one, and I got the job the next day. I still remember going to that interview. I was totally together. They couldn't wait to hire me. I was still quite crazy. I mean, after they hired me, I think they wondered, what have we got here? Because I was more immature than the students I was teaching and showed it. And this is where sponsorship came in. I had the same sponsor for 44 years. And he told me, he did some wonderful things with me. He showed me how to put the principles of the program into practice. Give you an example. I was in college, and, you know, these 19, 20-year-olds, they don't stand too much too well at being yelled at. And they had misbehaved, and I yelled appropriately. And this was not going well, so I called my sponsor, and he said, you know, he explained about how the energy we put out and what I had been, you know, giving out there, and that it was simply amplifying the negativity. And he said, tomorrow morning when you go into the classroom, you're going to do an apology. What? Never. He said, well, then get another sponsor. It's not going to be easy. But he said, you're going to stand up and you're going to explain that you've been away for a bit and that you're not handling things well and that you appreciate the fact that this is a two-way. So I went in there. I was shaking like a leaf. And I did that. And I still remember that morning, some of them started to cry, and they became my loyal followers. They cried like babies when I left, because he was right. And that's how he raised me in AA. So what happened my first 20 years? I became a good member of AA, and if you knew me at that time, Bob knows all about me. And I did AA well, in some respects. Inside, I was all about the outside, all about the outside. And I began, I paid off the debt, and then the voice said, buy a house. Huh? I don't have any money. And 10 days later, I bought my first house, and I bought lots of houses, and I built my own house. And I had the red convertible, and I had the fancy clothes, and I had the men, and I had the sex, and I had life going wonderfully on the outside and dying on the inside. Sitting at AA, and the odd time I'd tell somebody, I'm dying on the inside. And they'd say, go to more meetings. Well, I love meetings. But sometimes there is more required. That doesn't mean you don't go to meetings. But I'd sit there and people would say, oh, I'm no longer alone. I'm so grateful. And I'd think, I won't think what I said, thought inside. And I was dying inside. Not because AA was wrong. Not because my group was wrong. None of that. I had no relationship with God. You see, as I perceived it. Sure, God had a relationship with me. And as I said, God has never let me without what I needed. And I got it. A man came to speak at a conference and I heard him. He said, you know, things happened to me in childhood. And he explained how his business was failing. And he said, you know, he learned in childhood, you'll never succeed. You know, da 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 da. And he said, you know, he found out how, you know, he said, go look at step 8 in the 12 and 12. It says there, we have stuff buried below the level of consciousness. You know, if you think I'm talking about stuff I shouldn't, Bill talked about it. We bury the stuff below the level of consciousness. At the time of these occurrences, they have given our emotions violent twists, which have since discolored our personalities and altered our lives for the worse. And I did have a discolored personality. And my life had certainly gone for the worse. If you measured my life by the outside, you'd say, damn, she's doing good. And if you knew what was going on the inside, you'd have a totally different picture. I was dying on the inside. You see, when I was little, we went to church. We were Roman Catholic. And what I heard was, God is love and God is power. And I was raised on a picture of God separate from man. Separate from man. And that's what I thought it was. And therefore, this idea of whatever, I had no idea whatsoever. And so I found the teacher, and I found the place, and I came to the States, and because I thought all the smart people were in the States. And I learned about how the stuff had been buried. I learned as a child. Nobody cares about me. They don't listen to me. They don't fix what hurts me. So I guess I'm just not important. And you live with that kind of stuff and don't even know you're doing it. So I got the chance for a lot of healing. And life has changed. And I'll talk more about this latter part. But, you know, this is the amazing thing. If you heard me, you know I was a real sicko. And I'm not a sicko today. You know, that's the power of the program. And that's why I often say, you know, when sponsees are having trouble, hang in. Because I can't fix you. But I can help you do the things that'll take you down the path that will make it okay if you stay. I'll tell you basically, God put Father O'Brien in my life. He called me one day and he said, I want you to give retreats. I said, Father, you don't know me. I said, I've been excommunicated. And he said, I don't care about that. He said, I want you to come and give retreats. That was a big change for me. It forced me, because there's a decent piece of me. And I knew that if I were going to stand and give retreats, I had big work to do. And the stuff, the answers were put in my life. And the walls came down. You see, what I think, if I were to say, okay, I'm dying tonight, I would know that something wonderful had happened in my life. Because that little girl who always felt different, who always felt not loved, who always felt alone, I don't feel that way anymore. That, it's, you know, the healing, you could look at the houses I bought and the house I built and all that, and you say, that's a success. That was important. That was part of it. But in the final analysis, I'll tell you what happened to the houses and all of that. One day I was standing at school before I retired, and the voice said, you're done with the houses. Sell them. And I knew it was authentic. I called the agent and said, let's start selling the houses, and we're going to sell my house. And I did. And I've lived much more simply since that, because I've had other work to do. And, you know, it just seems to me that things have changed drastically. And, you know, as I talk about how I used to feel, I can hardly believe I am the same person. It's not perfect. I still feel sorry for myself some days, and I still feel, oh, you know, I don't have children. You know, the book is so smart. It says we made decisions based on self, which later put us into a position to be hurt. Why don't I have children? You know why? Because I had abortions. And, you know, whose fault is that? I made the decision based on self, which later puts me in a position to say, wouldn't it be nice to have children? Wouldn't it be nice to have grandchildren? But you know what? The grace of God makes all things equal, makes all things okay. And that doesn't mean, don't hear me say, I think I'm perfect. I'm not. I can be a real jackass some days. And the need... See, I'm thinking of something St. Augustine said, and then I'll sit down. Because isn't it interesting? I guess it would have been about 1600, maybe 1800 years ago, St. Augustine lived, and what he wrote was, he said, Thou hast made us for thyself, O God, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. And then, in 1938, 6, 7, whatever it was, what did Dr. Silkworth write? He said, we're restless, irritable, and discontent until we can again experience the sense of ease and comfort. And then he says, we need a vital spiritual experience. We need an entire psychic change. Same thing Augustine said, he just used different words. Isn't it just amazing? I'm so happy to be here. God bless.